Friedman plus Keynes, A New Equation, a talk given on the 13th of September 1980 by Ronald Burgess, Director of the Economic Study Association.
In August 1930, the number registered as wholly unemployed just tipped the 2 million mark. 25 years later, in 1955, after the Keynesian revolution had been accomplished, they are issued the lowest ever unemployment figures for the month of August, 181,000. Then came the counter-revolution in monetary theory. And after this August, a further 25 years on, the numbers registered as wholly unemployed tipped the 2 million mark once again. An historically accurate, though loaded, view of events. Those of you who read the appropriate columns in the newspapers and journals and tune in to the supposedly more serious radio and television programs will have been informed by the economic journalists and commentators that during the past 10 years there has opened up a great divide amongst academic economists. On the one side, you will have gathered, there are the Keynesians. Their champions are David Ricardo, Karl Marx, John Maynard Keynes, none of whom can now speak for themselves. Contemporary Keynesians, it would appear, are managed from Cambridge, with public relations from London by the National Institute of Economic and Social Research. You will have been informed also that Keynesians believe that money does not matter. On the other side of the divide are the monetarists. They have no need for separate management or public relations, as their champion is alive and well and living in the USA, Professor Milton Friedman, Nobel laureate. From constant repetition, you will know that monetarists believe that money does matter. Admittedly, there is a divide, but the mass media view I've just outlined is not only loaded, but also pays scant regard to historical accuracy. John Maynard Keynes, throughout his life, was very much concerned with money matters. Before the First World War, he was appointed to the Royal Commission on Indian Finance and Currency, then a most important issue for the government of Westminster. During the final years of his life, at the end of the Second World War, he was concerned with the Bretton Woods Agreement and negotiating the US loan. The former was a monetary agreement of worldwide importance, whilst the US loan saved this country from financial collapse. During the interwar years, Keynes published his treatise on money, which some argue is a more important work than his later general theory. David Ricardo, too, dealt with money and banking issues at great length, and it was in recognition of his expertise in the sphere of monetary economics that he was appointed a member of the Bullion Committee. From at least about 1581, when it is recorded that a crude form of the quantity theory of money reached Cambridge from France, all the established economic theorists, right through to the present day, have accepted that over a period of years, there is a positive and significant association between changes in the money supply and changes in the general price level. When the rate of increase in the money supply is persistently in excess of the rate of growth of real output, then, inevitably, prices will rise. A stable general price level requires the maintaining of a balance between changes in the money supply and changes in real output. There's no argument about this. Over the centuries, the available evidence from all countries has made the proposition incontrovertible. The academic divide between contemporary Keynesians and contemporary monetarists did not arise from a rejection by one side and the acceptance by the other of the quantity theory of money. The divide arises from a fundamental difference as to the nature and causes of unemployment. Fundamental to the Keynesian view is the theory that the volume of output in employment is a dependent variable, determined by factors largely within the control of government, fiscal and monetary policies. That the volume of output in employment is a dependent variable is central to the general theory of employment as formulated by Keynes in the 30s. He argued that the volume of output in employment is determined by the point of intersection between the aggregate demand function and the aggregate supply function. By contrast, fundamental to the contemporary monetarist view is the theory that the volume of output in employment is an independent variable. Independent in the sense that it is determined by factors not susceptible to control by government fiscal and monetary policies. The policy proposals of the two factions follow directly from their fundamental theoretical difference. Keynesian policy proposals are directed towards the discharging by government of their responsibilities for sustaining a high level of employment. The UK government accepted this responsibility with the publication of the 1944 White Paper. Monetarist proposals are directed towards eradicating inflation. Presumably, both sides would agree that inflation and unemployment is worse than inflation or unemployment. Moreover, the proposition that one evil is an improvement on two evils commends itself to common sense. The differences in policy proposals are, as I have said, the result of a fundamental difference, not so much in monetary theory as in employment theory. In any sphere, if a difference is to be resolved, then first it must be seen what is the difference. In this particular case, once the difference between contemporary Keynesians and contemporary monetarists is seen to be in the employment theory and not in whether money matters or does not matter over much, once this is seen, the divide can be bridged. Indeed, the academic dispute that creates the divide appears unnecessary, for it can be shown that the economics of Keynes and the recent developments in monetary theory are not incompatible, but in combination, they point the way to achieving a stable general price level, whilst at the same time sustaining a high level of economic activity. Contemporary monetarism was born out of a clash between what was then known as the Chicago School and a long-running academic dispute about the Phillips curve hypothesis. In 1956, the University of Chicago published a volume entitled Studies in the Quantity Theory of Money. It was the product of that university's workshop in money and banking. The volume was edited by Professor Milton Friedman, and he personally contributed the leading essay, The Quantity Theory of Money, a Restatement. According to the late Harry Johnson and others, the restatement was essentially a sophisticated version of Keynes' theory of liquidity preference. Professor Johnson was an important figure in the development and dissemination of the restated quantity theory. As a corporal in the Canadian Army, he had been a post-war undergraduate at Cambridge. Thus, he was well acquainted with the pre-Keynesian Cambridge quantity equation and the economics of Keynes. Later, he was a colleague of Professor Friedman at Chicago and also a professor at the LSE. However, regardless of the primary sources of Professor Friedman's statement, it did open the way for fruitful and scientific controversy, which led to important developments in monetary theory. The pre-Keynesian quantity theory of money assumed an automatic tendency towards full employment. A And as during the 30s this was manifestly in conflict with the facts of experience, the theory fell into disrepute. The restated quantity theory met these criticisms with a counter-contention. According to Professor Friedman, the restated quantity theory is, and I quote, in the first instance a theory of the demand for money. And he puts the word demand into italics for emphasis. He then goes on. It is not a theory of output, or of money income, or of the price level. In other words, the restated theory is not a theory of aggregate response to monetary change. The question of whether an economy responds to monetary impulses by price level or by output level is outside the scope of the restated theory. By setting itself free in this way, the Chicago School suffered a serious shortcoming. Its policy implications were not attractive to governments charged with the responsibility of maintaining a high level of employment. For example, when Professor Friedman visited this country in 1970 as leader of the Chicago School, the label monetarism was just beginning to gain ground. And in a lecture delivered at the Senate House of the University of London, he formulated what he called the 11 key propositions of monetarism. I quote the fourth proposition in full. The change rate of growth of nominal income shows up first in output and hardly at all in prices. If the rate of monetary growth is reduced, then about 6 to 9 months later, the rate of growth of nominal income and also of physical output will decline. However, the rate of price rise will be affected very little. There will be a downward pressure on prices only as a gap emerges between actual and potential output. As I understand this proposition, Professor Friedman, 10 years ago, was being quite explicit. A restrictive monetary policy will precipitate a slump. Providing that slump is sufficiently intensive, then, in due course, the rate of price rise will slow down. Not a statement likely to arouse passionate dissensions among academic theorists, or businessmen, or indeed anybody else. Equally, not a statement likely to appeal to politicians, even though the established Keynesian orthodoxy was incapable of proposing a solution to the persistent inflation that appeared inevitably associated with their demand management techniques. Or perhaps more accurately, in the light of events, the Keynesian orthodoxy was unable to propose a solution to inflation acceptable to free trade unions and to a free electorate. As George Brown, Barbara Castle, Edward Heath, and Jim Callaghan will testify. But no doubt these defeated politicians will testify also that they would have had no chance of remaining in power on the promise of precipitating a permanent slump in order to eradicate inflation. The restated quantity theory of money, which Professor Friedman was expounding in 1970, is, however, only one of the elements in contemporary monetarism. Another element, the element that makes contemporary monetarism attractive to politicians, evolved from a long-running academic dispute that followed upon the publication of an empirical study by Professor Phillips. It was entitled, The Relation Between Unemployment and the Rate of Change of Money Wage Rates in the United Kingdom, 1861 to 1957. This study was first published in a London journal in 1958, just 2 years after the publication in Chicago of Professor Friedman's restated quantity theory. Professor Phillips hypothesized that there was a negative functional relationship between the unemployment rate and the rate of change in money wages. As unemployment was reduced, the faster money wages increased. As unemployment rose, the rate of increase in money wages slowed, until, at a certain level of unemployment, the rise in money wages was halted. With stable money wages was created the possibility of a stable general price level. This relationship became known as the Phillips curve hypothesis. To beleaguered governments, attempting to maintain a high level of employment by demand management and at the same time keep inflation within bounds, the hypothesis offered the possibility of a trade-off between more or less unemployment and less or more inflation. Not only were the policy implications of the Phillips curve hypothesis attractive to politicians, but also the hypothesis seemed to provide a theoretical confirmation of a common view that the fear of unemployment is a necessary discipline for employees. This view was not and is not exclusive to employers in the so-called right-wing establishment. Mr. Ernie Bevin, as Minister of Labour in the wartime coalition, referred to it as the most unfortunate discipline of all, the economic whip. Professor Joan Robinson, a founder member of the Cambridge Group, who by no stretch of the imagination can be considered as a member of any right-wing orthodoxy, wrote in 1942, when the peacetime objective of full employment first came up for discussion, "The first function of unemployment, which has always existed in an open or disguised form, is that it maintains the authority of master over man." She went on, "Unemployment in a private enterprise economy has not only the function of preserving discipline in industry, but also, indirectly, the function of preserving the value of money. If free wage bargaining, as we've known it hitherto, is continued in conditions of full employment, there will be a constant upward pressure on money wage rates. In peacetime, the vicious spiral of wages and prices might become chronic. This would not only bring a variety of evils in its train, it would make hay of the Social Security program." By the mid-60s, given the impetus of Professor Phillips' study, Professor Paish, to take just one of many possible examples, was arguing that in the UK, a 2.25% rate of unemployment was sufficient to halt inflation. This could be reduced to a 2% rate if the trade unions were also restrained. Although the original Phillips curve hypothesis was soon found to offer no general explanation of post-war experience, it spawned a vast literature seeking to explain inflation in non-monetary terms. And in this, it was in direct opposition to the assertion of the Chicago School that inflation is always and everywhere a monetary phenomenon. Eventually, Professor Friedman was moved to attack, and on theoretical grounds, he described the Phillips curve hypothesis as utterly fallacious. He argued that whilst in the short run, unanticipated inflation would reduce real wages, and a reduction in real wages might be expected to be related to some expansion of employment, in the longer run, the inflation would be anticipated, with money wages and prices moving together in step. When this happened, both real wages and unemployment would return to their pre-inflation levels. "You cannot fool all the people all the time," echoed Professor Freeman. The true long-run Phillips curve is vertical, he concluded. This conclusion of Professor Friedman disposed of the Phillips curve hypothesis as a non-monetary explanation of persistent inflation. At first, people might be fooled by inflation. And as long as they were fooled, the Phillips curve might provide an explanation of events. But very quickly, people would cease to be fooled. They would come to expect inflation. When people cease to be fooled by inflation, the Phillips curve ceases to work. Professor Friedman's method of disposal, concluding the long-run Phillips curve to be vertical, meant that there must be for any economy a certain level of unemployment towards which that economy automatically tended, irrespective of the continuing rate of change in money, wages, and prices. This certain level of unemployment Friedman called the natural unemployment rate. From this concept, there was formulated the natural unemployment rate hypothesis, now more usually called the expectations augmented Phillips curve hypothesis. Thus, from Friedman's successful theoretical attack on the non-monetary explanation of inflation offered by the Phillips curve, there was added to the restated quantity theory of money a theory of output and employment. And with this combination, contemporary monetarism was born. The amalgam of the restated quantity theory of money and the expectation augmented Phillips curve has a great attraction for any government not seeking to establish a fully controlled state socialist or bureaucratic economy, although, nonetheless, wishing to eradicate inflation without causing prolonged mass unemployment. By the siren sounds of contemporary monetarism, politicians were encouraged to believe that the economics of Keynes and the derived Keynesian employment policies of necessity created inflation in the absence of extensive government control. In the short run, this inflation might be successful in reducing unemployment to below the natural rate, but in the longer run, the inflation would be anticipated, and then the unemployment would return to the natural rate regardless of the continuing actual rate of inflation. Academic monetarists entice politicians to believe that although monetary policies might cause a temporary hump in the rate of unemployment, in the longer run, they would achieve a natural unemployment rate without inflation. Why suffer inflation to no advantage? Sooner or later, the economy will return to its natural rate of unemployment, regardless of whether monetary policies are being pursued. All that Keynesian policies offer is the additional disadvantage of persistent inflation. It is the attractiveness of this argument that has led the present administration to attempt its experiment in monetarism. We may note that the possibility of this experiment succeeding in eradicating inflation without causing prolonged mass unemployment rests on whether the expectations augmented Phillips curve hypothesis does in fact work in practice. I suggest that this hypothesis is little better than a confidence trick, worked on politicians and the majority of the electorate through plausible academic theorists. I do not impugn the motives of these academics, for it would seem that in the heat of the theoretical dispute, their analytical powers were lulled by the sweetness of their own siren sounds and the weakness of their opposition. Contemporary monetarists argue that an economy automatically tends towards its natural rate of unemployment. and that this natural rate, therefore, is independent of government monetary and fiscal policies. This argument implies a fundamental difference from the theory of Keynes. For the theory of Keynes argues that the rate of unemployment is to a large extent determined by government's fiscal and monetary policies. However, I would hold that this apparent fundamental difference applies more in the form of words than in real substance. Full employment, as that term was used by Keynes in his general theory of employment, does not mean an absence of unemployment. Full employment, for the purpose of Keynes' general theory, is a theoretical benchmark. In given conditions, the volume of output in employment cannot be expanded ad infinitum. There must be a limit to the expansion. This limit Keynes called full employment. One may fault Keynes for using misleading terminology, but in his writings he made his definitions clear. The term full employment may be misleading, but there is no excuse for academics to be misled by Keynes. The general theory concept of full employment coincided with what Keynes called the point of true inflation. This was a precise and accurate description. At anything less than full employment, any increase in monetary demand would go in part to raising prices, and in part to expanding output and employment. But when full employment was reached, any further increase in monetary demand could not, by definition, expand output and employment. It must, therefore, go wholly in raising prices. For Keynes, full employment and true inflation were two ways of looking at the same condition. In chapter 20 of the General Theory, Keynes wrote of this condition, "We've now reached the situation in which the crude quantity theory of money is fully satisfied. For output does not alter, and prices rise in exact proportion to MV." Remember, in the general theory of employment as formulated by Keynes, full employment does not mean an absence of unemployment. It refers to a rate of unemployment that cannot be reduced further by government fiscal and monetary policies. The precise rate of unemployment that Keynes considered to be consistent with full employment is now a matter for conjecture. A pointer, perhaps, is that in 1937, when the numbers registered as wholly unemployed had fallen to less than 1.5 million, equivalent to a rate of between 9 to 10% on the basis then used for calculation, Keynes was arguing in the columns of the Times against additional central government expansion of monetary demand at that time as a means of achieving further reductions in unemployment. But what matters today is not the precise unemployment rate that Keynes had in mind in the 30s. What matters is what contemporary monetarists mean by their concept of a natural unemployment rate, as derived by them from the expectations-augmented Phillips curve. When it comes to providing estimates, contemporary monetarists are no more precise today than was Keynes during the 30s. In the early 70s, researchers at the University of Manchester tentatively suggested that the UK natural unemployment rate might be as low as 2%. Now, authoritative statements go no further than suggesting that whatever the natural unemployment rate might be, the rate has been rising steadily over recent years. It would seem that what contemporary monetarists are saying when they state that an economy always tends towards a natural unemployment rate, is that an economy always tends, in the terms of Keynesian theory, towards full employment. What contemporary monetarists call the natural unemployment rate is a variable independent of government monetary and fiscal policies to no greater or lesser extent than was Keynes' theoretical benchmark, which he called, perhaps misleadingly, full employment. Further, it would seem, the natural rate is no more capable of precise estimation than was Keynes' concept of full employment. The pre-Keynesian quantity theory of money assumed an automatic tendency to full employment by virtue of Say's law. During the interwar years of depression, this assumption was manifestly in conflict with the facts of experience, and the theory came to be accepted as too silly to be worth considering. Friedman's 1956 essay, freed the restated quantity theory of the Chicago school from the charge of being too silly and opened the way towards important new developments in monetary theory. Admittedly, the abnegation of responsibility for explaining the difference of the effects of monetary change between price and quantity movements was to prove a serious shortcoming for the school. But by incorporating the expectations augmented Phillips curve into monetary theory, the contemporary monetarists have turned a full circle. If the pre-Keynesian quantity theory of money is too silly to be worth considering, then so too is contemporary monetarism. To argue that an economy automatically tends towards a natural rate of unemployment is not substantially different from arguing that an economy automatically tends towards full employment. Certainly this is so, as that term was used by Keynes. We know that to argue that an economy automatically tends towards full employment is a nonsense. It conflicts with the facts of experience. What then are we to do? Do we reject monetarism? Do we reject also the recent developments in monetary theory? The danger in outright rejection is that the baby tends to go with the bathwater. In developing the theory of Keynes, post-war Keynesians tended to reject monetary theory, with dire results to the economy when their conclusions were applied in practice. Contemporary monetarists tend to reject the analysis of Keynes, and I predict their conclusions will have dire results to the economy if long pursued as practical policies. Yet inflation today is a malignant disease. We cannot afford to reject the lessons of monetary theory. But equally, we cannot afford to reject the theory of Keynes. Unemployment is an insidious social disease. Bearing in mind the weaknesses and strengths of the kind of economy in which we live and have to earn our living, it would seem that the right approach is to develop Keynes' general theory of employment in a way that can incorporate the recent developments in monetary theory. This approach, from where we are now in September 1980, includes the possibility, without any loss of freedom, of proceeding immediately and directly towards the eradication of inflation, whilst at the same time sustaining the highest possible volume of output and employment. This approach accords with the objective of political economy throughout the ages. Amongst those individual economists who have held the liberty of the subject and the free development of human nature in high regard, there are many differences of emphasis. There are many differences in their policy proposals. But these differences do no more than reflect changing conditions, a different starting point, not a different objective. To reach the equator from the Arctic, one travels south, but from the Antarctic, one travels north. When Keynes was charged by the academic establishment with changing his views in 1931, he wrote in the New Statesman and Nation, "I seem to see the older parrots sitting around and saying, 'You can rely on us. Every day for 30 years, regardless of the weather, we have said, what a lovely morning. But this is a bad bird. He says one thing one day and something else the next.'" Changing conditions require changes in public economic policies. And these policy changes require the continuous development of economic theory. Academic disputes and divides serve to bring honest differences into the light, so that the invalid may be rejected and the valid incorporated into the new. Disputes do not serve this purpose when they descend to strengthening entrenched positions, wherein the differences are more apparent than real. Worse, as in the case of the present divide between contemporary Keynesians and contemporary monetarists, the strengthening of entrenched positions tends to obscure the real nature of otherwise honest differences, and, as a result, prevents new development. As I have argued this evening, the present differences between contemporary Keynesian and monetarists is not so much a matter of monetary theory as of employment theory. Once this is seen, new developments in macroeconomic theory become possible. In the Economic Study Association, we have been working for some 15 years towards developing the economics of Keynes, so that it can incorporate the recent developments in monetary theory. We have had some moderate success, and we detail the developments in our seminar series. But in one evening's talk, you will appreciate that it is not possible for me to go through the results of 15 years' work. I trust, however, that what I have said tonight will be sufficient to enable us to draw some broad policy conclusions. In the words of Professor Pigou, it is for its fruit-bearing qualities, not for its light-bearing qualities, that economic knowledge is worth pursuing. We may start with a point of general agreement. If inflation is to be eradicated, then the rate of increase in the money supply must be brought into line with the rate of growth of real output potential. From this, there is no escape outside of a fully controlled economy. For the past 25 years, the rate of growth of real output potential for the UK on a full employment basis has been fractionally over 3% a year. This, then, must be the final objective of any succession of monetary supply targets. There are no insuperable difficulties about government controlling the money supply. We live in a monetary economy with a managed currency. Government is, as it were, the monopoly supplier of money, and therefore have absolute control. To eradicate inflation, government must keep the money supply under control. But in order to do so, they must give up attempting to exercise other controls. For example, they must give up trying to control interest rates. As any monopolist knows, or is soon taught by experience, he cannot control both price and quantity. In addition, government must accept also certain other disciplines, such as keeping their spending within bounds of their income. We all have to accept this discipline, so why not governments? Recent developments in monetary theory are important, since they leave no room for reasonable doubt that if government are to bring the money supply eventually into line with the growth of real output, without prolonging a slump, then the demand for money also must be reduced. If, through the exercise of their control over the money supply, government creates the conditions of a persistent excess demand for money, then they will cause a prolonged slump with mass unemployment. Now, as I have argued, government can control the money supply, but in a society such as ours, they cannot control the demand for money. But by developing the analysis of Keynes, we find that government can, and do, exert a significant influence over the demand for money through their fiscal policies. Thus it follows, in addition to accepting the monetary disciplines necessary to keep control over the money supply, government must also accept certain fiscal disciplines so as not to inflate the demand for money. The theory developed by the ESA predicts that the demand for money will be inflated by the tax shifting process when government taxing and spending exceeds a certain amount. This theoretical prediction is consistent with the conclusion Colin Clark deduced from an empirical study published in the Economic Journal of 1945. From this empirical study, based on pre-war evidence, Colin Clark concluded that when the general government tax revenue plus borrowing requirement exceeded a certain proportion of the net national income, then forces were set in motion which caused a persistent rise in costs and prices. Keynes, who was editor of the Economic Journal when the manuscript was received, agreed with Clark's conclusion and expressed the view that it would prove to be UK experience in the post-war years. The preliminary results from the ESA statistical researches, based on more recent data, indicate that for the UK, what Clark called the upper limit to taxation is today around 32%. Of our net domestic product at market prices. Throughout the post-war years, British governments have persisted in exceeding this limit, and there is a significant and positive relationship between the extent of their excesses and the rate of inflation. Thus, theory predicts, and empirical studies confirm, that when government taxing and spending exceed a certain limit, then the forces of the tax shifting process will persistently raise the general price level, and in this way, increase the demand for money. If this tax-inflated demand for money is not met by an inflationary supply of money, then a slump is inevitable. Further, if within this overall limit to government taxing and spending, the economy is to sustain the maximum volume of output and employment, consistent with a stable general price level, then government must accept the additional fiscal discipline of raising their tax revenue in a way that does not inflate the cost to firms of producing any particular volume of output. That is, using the terms of Keynes, government must eschew all taxes which directly inflate the aggregate supply price. These broad general policy conclusions are derived from incorporating the recent developments in monetary theory into a development of the economics of Keynes. Perhaps, as a final point, I can be more specific. What about this country in September 1980? I have argued that monetary policy is not enough. This was Sir Keith Joseph's contention before the general election. However, if this government is to eradicate inflation without causing prolonged mass unemployment, the Chancellor needs to look not so much at what more he must do, as to what he is doing and can stop doing immediately. With over 2 million unemployed and rising, the Chancellor continues to impose employment taxes, pay-as-you-earn, social security contributions, national insurance surcharge, etc., which in total are equivalent to a VAT rate of over 40%. Not only does this imposition increase unemployment, but by directly increasing the aggregate supply price, it also inflates the demand for money. So far, the Chancellor during his term of office has persistently inflated prices and the demand for money. As a consequence, he has failed dismally to control the quantity of money. His fiscal and monetary policy have been, and continue to be, directly opposed to each other. One way or another, this opposition of policies must be stopped if the economy of this country is to recover from what is now a worldwide depression. Milton, thou shouldst be living at this hour. England has need of thee. The former poet laureate's cry has been answered by a Nobel laureate. An answer Wordsworth never dreamed of. But we needed a re-emphasis of the importance of monetary discipline. But we needed that re-emphasis not at the expense of wholly rejecting that great Cambridge economist who, more than any other, by his theoretical and practical work, laid the foundation for 25 years of post-war prosperity and growth.